Welcome to Human Rights 2020s, a podcast from the Human Rights Consortium Scotland. This episode is a recording from an event called Our International Human Rights, the Human Rights Act, held on the 19th of June 2024. In this episode, Senior Policy Officer Lucy Miller introduces Carolyn Miller, no relation, from the British Institute for Human Rights to discuss the Human Rights Act. We hope that you enjoy this episode.
I'll just get going now. Thank you all so much for joining us. This is the last in our lunchtime series of human rights chats for now. And I'm delighted to introduce it today. We'll be talking about the Human Rights Act and our upcoming Scottish Human Rights Bill. So I'm not going to assume anyone's knowledge in this and just give you a bit of a spiel about where we stand with the Human Rights Act and how this will relate to a Scottish Human Rights Bill. So I'm Lucy, I'm the Senior Policy Officer here at the Consortium. So in the realm of human rights, the United Kingdom has long been guided by the Human Rights Act of 1998, which enshrines fundamental rights and freedoms into law, ensuring that they are upheld and respected across the UK. These rights are drawn from what we call the European Convention on Human Rights, and cover a wide range of civil, political and social rights that form the cornerstone of democratic society in the UK. And we have some work on that from the end of last year. If anyone would like to see it, we'll put that in the resource bank. However, as societal norms evolve and international human rights frameworks continue to develop, there's growing recognition of the need for broader and more inclusive human rights protections. Sometimes we call these our everyday rights. This recognition is particularly evident in Scotland, where the government is pioneering efforts to expand the scope of human rights legislation beyond our current framework provided by that Human Rights Act. So the Scottish government's plans centre around the introduction of a comprehensive human rights bill. And unlike the current legal landscape, which primarily focuses on civil and political rights, the proposed legislation seeks to incorporate economic, social and cultural rights, or we call ICESCR, recognising them as essential elements of human dignity and well-being and putting that within our legal framework. ICESCR, again, the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, outlines these rights, including things like the right to work, the right to education and the right to an adequate standard of living, which are crucial for ensuring a decent quality of life for everyone. Moreover, the Scottish Government's Human Rights Bill aims to give due regard to several other important international human rights treaties, including CRPD, the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, emphasising equality and non-discrimination for persons with disabilities, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, or CERD, which promotes racial equality and combats racial discrimination, and the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, or CEDAW, advocating for gender equality and the empowerment of women. By incorporating the principles and obligations outlined in these treaties into domestic law, Scotland aims to strengthen protections against various forms of discrimination and ensures equal opportunities for treatment of all of its people. Furthermore, the Scottish Government's commitment to a human rights bill extends to recognising the right to a healthy environment as a fundamental human right. This emerging right acknowledges that environmental health is intricately linked to human well-being and prosperity. And by embedding this right into law, Scotland will seek to foster sustainable development practices, protect natural ecosystems and mitigate the adverse effects of environmental degradation. We did do a session on the right to a healthy environment last week, which you can listen to on our website. In essence, while the Human Rights Act of 1998 has provided a solid foundation, and I'm sure Carolyn will be able to answer a few more questions on it, or a solid foundation for safeguarding political and civil liberties in the UK, the Scottish Government's proposed Human Rights Bill presents a bold step towards a more holistic and inclusive approach to human rights protection. By expanding the legal framework to encompass economic, social and cultural rights, and integrating international human rights standards such as CRPD, CERD, CEDAW and the right to a healthy environment, Scotland aims to create a society where everyone can enjoy their full range of human rights with teeth, free from discrimination and inequality. But today is a bit more focused on the Human Rights Act, so we're just going to get into that with Carolyn from the British Institute for Human Rights. So Carolyn, would you like to introduce yourself and your role there?
Sure, thanks Lucy. Hi everyone, I'm Carolyn. I am the Head of Policy and Programmes at the British Institute of Human Rights, or BIHR. tends to be what we're called. My role there is basically a head up policy programs, essentially. So it's probably more interesting to tell you a bit about my background. I've been working in human rights since 2012. In Scotland mostly, within care homes, care at home and house and support. And then I moved that into the Scottish Government and worked on sort of human rights policy through the Self-Directed Support Act. And then for the last 6 years, I've been at BIHR and we work UK-wide. And our focus is on the implementation of the Human Rights Act. So my job involves working with public bodies to make sure that they implement their legal duties under the Human Rights Act. So we work with housing services, asylum and immigration services, health and care services, prisons and sort of beyond. So my job is really focused on the implementation of the law. And then at policy level, we sort of advocate for rights respecting policy and practice as well. So yeah, at BIHR, we work UK-wide, but also do lots of kind of practice-based work in Scotland particularly.
Thanks for that, Carolyn. And I think this session, this lunchtime is more of an unusual one to the ones we've just done over the last few weeks, because we are talking about what has happened and not a theoretical here, which is really interesting to see how we've dealt with human rights law in the past. So could you, I've given a tiny bit of an introduction to it, but give me a brief introduction to the Human Rights Act and what it is, its significance and how it has shaped human rights protection in the UK so far.
Yeah, I will try to do that. So the Human Rights Act was passed in 1998, and as you said, Lucy, it brings down most of the rights within the European Convention on Human Rights into domestic law in the UK. So that means if you're in Northern Ireland, Scotland, England or Wales, since 1998, you can bring a legal case under the Human Rights Act in the UK. We still obviously are protected by the ECHR, so still have access to the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, but the intention of the Human Rights Act was to bring those rights closer to home. So it was thought in 1998 that if we took the rights within the ECHR and brought them into our own law in the UK, what would happen is that we would create a culture of respect for human rights in the UK. And there's a definition of a culture of respect for human rights, which is something around a culture of respect for human rights would be people knowing their rights and being able to claim them, and sort of public bodies, public officials knowing their duties and sort of being held to account under those duties. So that was the intention of the Human Rights Act in 1998. We thought, let's bring the rights in the ECHR closer to home, justice closer to home. That will create a culture of respect for human rights. Now, in terms of the Act itself, it has sort of 16 rights. It protects things like our right to life, our right to liberty, our right to non-discrimination, our right to private life, family life, enjoyment of our current home, our right to protest, our right to join a trade union, our right to freedom of expression, our right to freedom of religion. So it is a sort of really broad bit of human rights law, and it puts legal duties on public bodies and those delivering public functions to respect, protect and fulfil human rights in everything they do. So basically, if you live in the UK and you're interacting with a public body, let's say hospital, GP, police, housing, social housing, then you can expect that that public body should uphold your rights. And if they don't, you can then challenge that. You can challenge that sort of in advocacy, or you can challenge that kind of legally as well. So that was the dream of the Human Rights Act. And I think in terms of like the second part of your question, which I think is about kind of like whether that's like what's the significance of it or how has it shaped human rights protection? I think that basically that depends on sort of who you are and where you live. And I mean, I work every day with public bodies who are trying to implement the Human Rights Act, and I work every day with people in communities who are trying to claim their rights. So I see how successful it is when people know the law and use it. And I truly, truly believe in that, because I've seen the difference it makes to mental health care, to social care, to education, when, you know, people are aware that they have a right to this and public bodies know that they need to do that. However, that only works if those public bodies know that they have those duties and are properly trained to do it. And I think that in terms of how successful the Human Rights Act's been, it's been 26 years since the Human Rights Act. And I mean, I'm sure a lot of people on this call who maybe, you know, work in advocacy or work for community organisations, or perhaps are a person themselves, so they support loved ones, we know that rights are not real for everyone every day. They absolutely aren't. So the Human Rights Act has the potential to do that, in my opinion, but only if it's properly resourced and properly implemented. Otherwise, it's just a bill. And it's yes, you can take a legal case if something goes wrong, and that's crucial. Like, justice and remedy is crucial. But actually, at that point, the thing's already happened, and it's actually really difficult to take a legal case. It's not that easy to just take a legal case. It doesn't happen that often. So for us, if you want a culture of respect for human rights, you need to focus on implementation of the law. And yeah, that's kind of what I do. But no, under no kind of, don't know the word, but like, yeah, I don't believe that it's happening every day for everyone. And I'm sure there's people on this call that campaign for human rights change across various sectors, and they know that it's not the case for everyone every day either. So yeah, I think that's the main things you need to know about the Human Rights Act.
It's a great overview. And I know this will be difficult because we don't have a Scottish Human Rights Bill at the moment, but are you able, like in your work, have you already seen comparisons between maybe what was set out to be achieved with the UK Human Rights Act and potential features of a Scottish Human Rights Bill?
Well, I think it in terms of, so that's a good question. Like, why have a Scottish Human Rights Bill if you've got a Human Rights Act, which is already the law and is already a bringing down of an international convention like the ECHR? And the reasoning behind it is that, well, I mean, there's various reasoning behind it, but like the key thing is that the concept of that or the idea of that lets enshrine more protections in law that people in Scotland can access. So let's not just have an international convention on something, let's have it in our domestic law. It's that same concept, isn't it? Bring it into law here and we'll see it happen. So I think that's what the Scottish Human Rights Bill is obviously trying to do, and it's sort of it sets out to bring in additional rights protection. So it's sort of, we've got the Human Rights Act, but it's a bill that's trying to build on that and say, actually, these are all these other things that aren't currently protected that should be. And the bill itself is, you know, as you know, it incorporates four different treaties which are specific to particular groups of people, women, disabled people, minoritized communities. So they're trying to like enshrine in law those kind of additional or specific protections as well for those groups, and that's a good thing. It's a move to broaden out protections and to set them out within Scotland, and I think it's the way we should be going, and it's a really good trajectory that like other nations in the UK, you know, and Wales, there's work to do similar stuff as well. But yeah, they could kind of look to and learn from. And so, yeah, I think that's what the bill is trying to do. And it's important to say that it doesn't replace the Human Rights Act, it builds on the Human Rights Act. The Human Rights Act will still be there, it will still be the law in Scotland. And this is an attempt to kind of build on that. In terms of like comparisons, I guess, I mean, my main thing around the bill is let's not get 26 years down the line having not implemented it. And
Yeah.
I think that's the real concern because it's very, very complex. It's a very complex bill. And actually, I know from training public bodies sort of for the last 10 years that the Human Rights Act is a very simple piece of law. It's very straightforward. It's 16 rights and the duties are quite straightforward. And that takes time. It takes, you know, a long time to get people completely doing that in their culture and in their practice. So I think that would be the only thing to kind of flag there around comparisons. Like, let's make sure that the focus is not just on passing the law, but on making sure it happens for people.
Definitely. And can you explain the key features and objectives of the UK Human Rights Act and how it serves to protect human rights in the UK? Like how, I guess
Yeah.
coming back to that implementation point, you I know you've acknowledged that rights aren't real for everyone, but you have seen successful case studies of it. So even if you could, if you have an example, that would be brilliant, but no pressure to give that either.
Yeah, no, the basic features of the Human Rights Act are that all public bodies and those delivering a public function, so that's interesting as well, as it's really broad. So it's not just about your traditional public bodies. So thinking about nowadays, if you're accessing a state body, it's not always the state, is it? Like if you go to a hospital or maybe you're receiving care and it's actually not always delivered by the local authority, is contracted out, isn't it? It's contracted out to a charity or a private provider. And that's the same with prisons occasionally, and that's the same with some schools. And so what the Human Rights Act does, which is a key feature, is it says that the legal duty to uphold rights isn't just on public bodies, it's on anyone delivering a function of public nature. So it's really broad, and it means that we should be protected, kind of, if we, it's about the nature of the act, not the nature of the body. So if the thing that a body is delivering, you know, health, care, education, is public in nature, then they have legal duties to uphold human rights. So that's one key feature, which is super important, because it's served us over the test of time, hasn't it? When we now are at a point where the state actually doesn't deliver lots of the key services anymore, they contract them out. So that's one of the key features, and that's really important, I think. The other key feature is the duty that it puts on public officials and those delivering the function of public nature, which I won't keep saying, is that they have to respect rights. So that means they have to not make decisions in their practice every day which could unlawfully restrict rights or breach rights. So that's not just frontline practice. That means the commissioning of public services, procurement of processes, policies written by public bodies and the state, as well as the delivery of those services on the front line. So everything should be being done from a human rights perspective. And it also sets out, under Section 3 of the Human Rights Act, that other bits of policy and legislation should be applied compatibly with the Human Rights Act. And that's even stronger in Scotland, because law ceases to exist if it's found not to be compatible with the Human Rights Act. So really key features that are important. In terms of like an example of the difference that it made, I mean, I've got so many examples from work, but I'll try and talk through just a couple. Mental health wards, for example, where people are in inpatient care. Lots of our work is around ensuring that people's rights are respected when they're in it, when they're in inpatient care, making sure they have the right to liberty, although that's one of those rights that can be limited. If it's going to be limited, it has to be lawful, it has to be for a legitimate aim, and it has to be proportionate. So we've kind of worked with people to make sure that they're entitled to leave, they're entitled to contact with family, like to develop an ordinary family life. That's under the Human Rights Act. If you're in inpatient care or residential care or prison, you have a right to ordinary family relations under the Human Rights Act. So we've done lots of work just to make sure that that is happening. We also did that over COVID, kind of explaining to providers that, yes, the right to family contact is one of those rights that can be limited. And under COVID, there was a legitimate aim at certain periods of time, which was around protection of life and the prevention of spread of infection. But our kind of work during that time was to say, well, is a complete ban on that proportionate? What else could you be doing? Because people still have a right to family contact. So we were supporting public bodies to think about how they could ensure ordinary family relations when people couldn't meet face to face. So, you know, were they offering Zoom calls? Were they arranging for people to meet with their family members outside? Were they ensuring mobile phones, which are sometimes confiscated if you're in a secure facility? So yeah, kind of lots of those kind of things. We've also done lots of work with housing providers. Human Rights Act covers the right to non-discrimination. So if you're receiving social housing, we've done work to make sure that that's accessible. We've done lots of work in asylum accommodation as well, peaceful enjoyment of possessions where people's possessions have been removed. Again, sometimes that can be lawfully justified if it's a possession that causes that person or others harm. But the majority of the time, it's removal of people's phones or personal property, and kind of the Human Rights Act has supported us to challenge and the people we work with to challenge as well and say, actually, I have a right to peaceful enjoyment of possessions under the Human Rights Act, and any limitation of that needs to be lawfully justified and needs to be least restrictive, and completely removing my phone is not. So the kind of Human Rights Act framework is fairly simple. We've also seen the ending of use of restraint, use of seclusion, use of segregation, where we've done work within mental health units and explained that actually it could be a risk of inhuman integrated treatment, which is one of those absolute rights, which means that it can never be limited or limited by the state. So they have to stop doing that right now, basically. We've seen lots of practice and policy change across health settings, particularly forensic settings, prisons as well, to change practice. So it's just a case of, if people understand the law and the rights that we are protected by, then change can definitely happen and people can also challenge. I'm always reluctant to say that though, because I do think that, yeah, people should know their rights, but it's not the responsibility of me as a service user with my child at school to be shouting and arguing for my rights. It's their responsibility to be upholding them. So that is key. People should know their rights and they should be able to claim them. But there's a much bigger part of the puzzle than that, which is that actually public bodies should be respecting them. And that's kind of, yeah, gets lots of the focus and the power of the Human Rights Act. And it does work when people know it, I think.
That's really good. It's really, and it is really powerful to know about its power. But what, I guess, on the flip side of that, what have been some of the significant challenges and criticisms faced by the UK Human Rights Act? And can Scotland draw from its experience when incorporating a new bill? And how might these inform the development of a bill in Scotland?
The criticisms are that people don't know about it. So, like, I don't know about anyone on this call. I mean, you're all here because you're kind of interested in human rights. So you probably do. But I can't tell you the amount of meetings I go into where I'm talking about the Human Rights Act and people have no idea what the Human Rights Act protects or covers. So how can you see the results of a law when people and public bodies do not know about it and have not been supported to use it? So that's one of the criticisms that the Scottish Bill, I think, is trying to learn from. Like, trying to do lots of that work around when this passes, we want to be at a point where everybody sort of knows it. But I do have some worries about that because it is quite complex, and I know how hard it is to kind of deliver training on human rights legal duties and to do that in a plain language way. And sometimes we kind of fall short of that, I think. And it needs to be done in a practical way. And actually, a lot of the kind of webinars that I go on, sometimes they're so about the law. We're going to do this, we're going to do that, and there's a right to this. And nobody talks about practice or what that means for people every day. And I think that's something that could be done better. Like, if we're going to talk about the right to something, let's explain what that right is, and let's explain how it works, and let's explain what that looks like in practice. Use stories, use examples. So I think that's all stuff that the kind of Scottish Bill can learn from. The other big criticism is that it's not been implemented. We did a study during COVID, I won't go into why, but and I think it was 68% of the public bodies, public officials that we trained had never had human rights training before. My mum's a nurse, my dad's a support worker, he works with disabled kids, and neither of them have ever had human rights training at their work, and the Human Rights Act's been law for how long? So if you want that to happen, you're going to need to do that stuff, and it is going to take a lot of time. You can't just give someone one-off human rights training. It has to be completely embedded in everything a public body does, when they set their policies, when they do this, when they interview, when they do all of these things, as well as when they're making decisions day to day. So I think main criticisms are that people don't know about it and that it's not implemented. There's another criticism that people talk about it kind of not being broad enough and it being quite limited to sort of civil and political rights is the language that's often used. Personally, I think that's a misunderstanding of the Human Rights Act. If you don't know case law, and why would most people? So it's not a criticism, but it's, if you looked at the right to private family life, home and correspondence, for example, and you just looked at what was on the legislation, you'd think, okay, private life, it covers privacy. That's not that broad. We are going to need to add some more protections. But actually, if you read like the Council of Europe's guide and you see the case law, so case law sets the precedent, lets us know what's protected. If you read the guide to private life, you'll see that private life in the Human Rights Act covers self-determination. It covers our autonomy to make decisions about our body, our life, decisions about care or treatment or recovery. It covers our relationships with others. It covers our participation in the community. It covers it covers so many things about us in terms of our like integrity, physical and mental integrity. It covers dignity. Like, all of that sits under private life in the Human Rights Act. And also we've got family life. And so when people refer to them as civil and political rights and not everyday rights, I don't understand it, because every day I want my family life, I want autonomy, I want privacy, and certainly I want dignity, I want the right to life, I want not to be discriminated against. Like, for me, those are everyday rights, and everyone that I'm working with every day who are in sometimes quite vulnerable positions, those are everyday things for them. And I think sometimes the Human Rights Act gets criticised as like, oh, well, it's the right to protest and stuff. It's so much more than that. And actually, I think that when we're moving on to the new implementation of the Scottish Bill, there needs to be proper understanding of what the Human Rights Act does as well, actually, more than a surface level. It's this. And that takes time. And I know it because I've been doing it for 12 years. So I don't expect anyone else to know that, but it is the case.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess, I mean, that's a problem we come against all the time in the consortium whenever we do work with members or the general public or people that have faced human rights violations, is that no one has any idea where this information lies or how to access it. And that, to me, is the real problem of implementation, is that the law may be good and the legislation may be good, but you don't know how to use it then. Then what, what are we doing? And I guess on that, we have had 26 years with the Human Rights Act, and how are those rights under that act enforced? How are they held to account, and what mechanisms are in place to ensure compliance and address those violations?
In terms of enforceability, because we have because it's now enshrined in domestic law, it does mean that if your rights are breached by a public body, you can, in theory, take a legal case against that public body. And if you win that case, then what will happen is you will sometimes receive damages, but perhaps kind of more importantly, systematically, is that there will be a judgment which says this is what that public body needs to look at and do better. And that sometimes leads to sort of precedent. So if you have one case in a hospital, for example, and then people see that there was a legal case against that hospital, that can then change practice because there is a bit of a panic of like, oh, they were fined for this and we need to have a look at that and do that ourselves. So legal remedy, I guess, is that enforcement thing. And the fulfilled duty on public bodies is a procedural duty on them, which means that if they breach rights, public bodies have a legal duty to properly investigate and take positive action to prevent it from happening again. So where a rights issue is raised, there is that duty on public bodies and legal cases can be taken. I guess what I said earlier still applies in terms of how often legal cases are taken under the Human Rights Act, how difficult that is, cuts to legal aid, etc. It's not that easy to do. There are lots of charities that kind of do it brilliantly and they support people to do that. And it's I wouldn't take away from how important that is, but I think how you ensure enforcement is, I guess, as I've said, you make sure it doesn't go wrong in the first place, by making sure that people know about these things and that public bodies are regulated. So in terms of like who would be checking a public body, before we got to that point to make sure they were upholding rights, I mean, that falls to regulators. So regulators are public bodies who have legal duties to uphold human rights. So in their regulation of public services, they should be using a human rights-based approach to regulation. And that Scottish Government did lots of work with the Care Inspectorate on the national care standards at that time. And that was done using a human rights-based approach. And the CQC in England now are doing the same. They've just launched their new human rights approach to regulation. So if you have your regulators doing that, or your Ofsted, or your, all these other bodies, if they are doing it from a human rights perspective, then that's a kind of way of enforcement because, you'll get a low rating if your practices aren't human rights compliant. But I would argue that that's not done enough. And sometimes I see kind of frameworks for regulation, and there's no questions about human rights. And
Yeah.
are those regulators trained to spot human rights issues?
Yeah, exactly. There's so many layers to this, and it's so
Yeah,
complex. But that's
everyone's going to need to be fully trained on how to do this.
exactly. That's why we need the great work of the BIHR.
Oh well, there's only
So
six
bad
of us, so
workplace.
we'll not be able to help very much. But well, we can definitely we do offer training, but yeah, we need a lot more than us.
Brilliant. I'm just going to ask one more question, and it's basically about incorporating international standards here. So how can international human rights standards be effectively integrated into a Scottish human rights bill? Sorry, I'm a bit more focused on this one this time. But what examples from our Human Rights Act can guide that process?
So, Lucy, say it again. How can international standards be effectively incorporated?
Integrated into the Scottish Human Rights Bill, and are there any examples from the UK Human Rights Act that could guide that process?
I mean, my understanding is what's happening in the Scottish Human Rights Bill is that they are taking the wording from those international conventions and then simply putting it into the Scottish Bill. So, and then obviously when that passes, it then becomes law in Scotland, and it then means you can take a case if one of those things are breached. Important thing to say, which is another thing that people not to assume knowledge of, is that currently these international conventions, they don't have legal remedy as such. So they don't come alongside a court, the UN ones, or a kind of police force. The European Commission on Human Rights is different. It does come alongside a court in Strasbourg and in France. But the international conventions, like the ones that this bill tries to is going to sort of incorporate, the only way to sort of hold bodies accountable under an international convention is through like processes like universal periodic review. So every certain number of years, the UN do some peer review around how well a state is performing their duties under the convention that they've signed up to, and they then produce recommendations and say, actually, you should be doing all of these things better. And then it's up to that member state to listen to that and do it. And I think that doesn't always happen. The state can decide to accept or sort of reject the recommendations of the UN. So although so I think what incorporating it will do, which is what the Human Rights Act did with the ECHR as well, is that it's an opportunity to make sure that those things are enshrined in law. And then that people can actually challenge, and that there's a legal duty on public bodies, and that it is what we call a hard duty. Do you know what I mean? So it's a duty that is enshrined in our domestic law, whereas sometimes you'll refer to international legislation, you'll hear it referred to as soft law, and it's not that that's not crucial. It is, and actually lots of these conventions are used in advocacy all the time, and they are used to challenge public bodies. It's simply that there isn't then a legal process that can kind of follow that for a person. So I think that's why it's really important. I don't know if that answered your question, but I don't know if I understand your question well enough. That
Oh
was
no,
my
it
attempt.
definitely understands it. I think it the question was all about bringing that international into a domestic framework, and you answered that perfectly. That is actually all we have time for today, so a good way to end that. And I would just like to remind everyone that all of our lunchtime webinars are recorded and on our website and available to listen to if you did happen to miss one, or there was a right or treaty that you would like to go through. We also created infographics for ICESCR, CEDAW, CRPD, and CERD, which can be viewed on our website or social media as well. And also, I've been told to flag that we have our first National Human Rights Conference in Scotland coming up on the 11th of September, which will take place in Glasgow. Rebecca will send out more details of that within our newsletter and further comms for anyone that would like to come along, but please do mark your calendars for that. It will be all day, and we would love to see as many of you there as possible. But yeah, just final thing to say is a big thank you to Carolyn and BIHR for coming along and being with us today, and hope you have a lovely rest of your week.
Thanks for having me, Lucy, and thanks everyone for coming. Hope it was helpful.
Definitely was. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Human Rights 2020s podcast. For more information about our work as Scotland's civil society network for the protection and promotion of human rights, please visit our website at www.hrcscotland.org or follow us on Twitter at HRC Scotland. Thank you.